This is KZSU, Stanford. Here we go. Making it real compared to what? A Steve Hunter groove for the Roving Brigade to usher in a new year here on Entitled Opinions, Annus Domini 2026. The track is called On the Edge of Uncertainty. If I were ever to write a book with that title, On the Edge of Uncertainty, the subtitle would be The Human Condition. Why? Because uncertainty is the element we're immersed in. From uncertainty comes wonder, religion, world-making, science, love, prophecy, and social relations, not to mention Pascal's wager. Uncertainty permeates our everyday experience, not because of some deficiency in us, but because it belongs to the unfinished story of the world. The edge of uncertainty is where destiny takes shape, where we insert ourselves into its unfolding plot, and co-create the future by acting, aspiring, choosing, risking, and failing. If we're Nietzschean enough to love fate, it's because fate weaves the uncertain into its fabric. Amor fati, amor incognita. What we love about fate is its inscrutability. That doesn't mean that some things are not certain. And hell is certain, wrote Eugenio Montale in the last verse of one of his poems. In hell, no exit. In hell, certainty reigns. But where there's uncertainty, the possibility of a way out remains open. The topic of our show today is the American philosopher William James, godson of Ralph Waldo Emerson and brother of Henry James, both of whom have their place in our pantheon. Shortly, I will ask my guest whether I'm right to suspect that William James viewed uncertainty as inherent to life, freedom, and action in what he called an open universe, filled with possibilities and maybes. A universe in which we humans collaborate with a finite, non-omnipotent, non-all-knowing God in the ongoing creation of the world. Mark Gonerman joined me once before on Entitled Opinions back in 2024 when we did a show on bioregionalism and the re-inhabitation of place. By way of bio for today's show, I'll simply mention that Mark Gonerman became interested in the comparative philosophy of religions when, in the late 70s, he circumnavigated the globe and bore witness firsthand to the varieties of religious experience in Egypt, India, Taiwan, Japan, and places in between. He holds graduate degrees in religion and East Asian studies from Harvard and here at Stanford. He has lived at the intersection of Christian and Buddhist studies. Whether Mark is in the library or roaming about the streets, William James, with his spirit of open-ended adventure, has been a constant companion. Mark Gonerman, welcome back to Entitled Opinions.
Thank you, Robert. It's an honor to be here. And congratulations on 20 years.
Thank you.
I have a James quote, William James quote, in celebration of that, if I may.
Let's do.
The community stagnates without the impulse of the individual, and the impulse dies away without the sympathy of the community. And I thank you for being that person that has created a mutually edifying place on air for us to come together.
Thank you, the individual, but as the quote confirms, it's really the community that makes it all happen, no? Yeah, Entitled Opinion is a combination of dialogue, monologue, and essentially communion with the listeners,
yes,
who are the ultimate community of Entitled Opinions, for
and
sure.
And you have their sympathy and affection.
Well, I don't know what I've done to earn it, but I'll take it gladly. So before we get into James' views on uncertainty and the book that he's most famous for, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which we're going to dwell on today, let's start with a little bio, especially with James, who had a very interesting family background.
Yes, James was born in 1842. He died in 1910. And if we back up to his grandfather, William, who emigrated from Ireland in 1789 to Albany, New York, began to work in a dry goods store, eventually owned the store, eventually owned Albany, and then went on to buy Syracuse and the salt springs there, which enabled him to finance the building of the Erie Canal, thereby creating the generational wealth that William James's family enjoyed, which then led to a very unusual kind of education. His father, Henry James Sr., who had had a very bad accident as a teenager, leading to the amputation of a leg, took over the boy's education while William James's mother took care of domestic duties. And so the boys, William and Henry, grew up with a transatlantic education. His father thought he should be educated in the sciences, so off they go to Geneva, to Paris, back and forth with tutors. Although eventually James thinks he wants to be a landscape painter, and they come back to Newport and he studies with William Morris Hunt. And this begins a quest by the young man for a vocation, an effort to find his place in the world, something he was actually very worried about. Is he worthy? And this sense of whether or not he was really worthy and capable was one inheritance from his father's Calvinist background.
Mm-hmm. You mean worthy in the eyes of his father or in the eyes of some other God or community? Worthy according to what Christ's standard?
Well, worthy to live on this earth and make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
His godfather, Ralph Waldo Emerson, wrote a poem, Give All to Love, which had a big impact on the young William. And yet James felt, especially because he was suffering from various maladies, that maybe he had some inherent faults mm-hmm. that wouldn't allow him to become the person he wanted to become.
So you mentioned Henry, the brother. There's also a sister.
Yes, Alice.
Alice, important person, actually, in the trio. It's a trio.
Yes, 5 years younger and a diarist and very much worth reading.
Yeah. So I think we can safely say that William James ended up becoming worthy of whatever his expectation was in that regard. And let's maybe turn to what he is known for having achieved the kind of major achievements that make him one of the, you know, most prominent names in the history of American philosophy.
Well, it was a long struggle, and it was helped. His path became clearer as he read poets such as Wordsworth, as he read philosophers, especially the French Charles Renouvier, because he, as you said in your introduction, eventually found his way to a free and open world, but he was terrified by the notion of being in a block universe where everything was already set. And when he read Renouvier, he had a sense that he could declare for himself freedom of the will. So he said, my first act of free will be to declare that I am free. And from that point on, he lived as a free man, though he also had to suffer through a lot of depression, even suicidal depression, off and on. And partly as he would go to Europe, he would be seeking cures. He was able, after finishing medical school, the only degree he earned was the MD, he was hired by Charles William Eliot, the president of Harvard, to teach physiology, then eventually to teach psychology, then eventually to teach philosophy.
Psychology being a very new science at the time.
Yes. As James said, the first lecture he ever heard in psychology was the one he gave himself after working 12 years on two volumes called The Principles of Psychology, published in 1890, which then established a foundation for a field that drew in graduate students. And so he began actually with a sense of embodied experience. and laboratory research to try to understand the mind-body connection, and became tired of the laboratory and the German model, and became more interested in the French clinical world that would take into account the larger life history and person who was suffering. With James, he became a doctor, never practiced, was very interested in diagnosis, but also noticed that the cures weren't very good, and that, in fact, a lot of people suffered, including his immediate family members. And especially when he lost a son, age 18 months, in 1884-85, who suffered horribly from the supposed cures that didn't work. And James felt that actually the moral bearing of the physician had a greater effect on healing than anything really that was being done medically at the time. And that is important for the varieties of religious experience, where James talks about the mind cure movement, which we can talk more in more detail about later.
Did he have a theory of psychopathology or of psychosis, or was he too empirical for that?
He was trying to figure it out. I mean, he learned a lot from the French hypnotists, yeah, like Pierre Janet, finding out the different levels of the subliminal mind and discovering that people could be cured by tapping into certain levels of awareness. Actually, he studied the Bourne identity case originally and was able to think about multiple selves and the relation of multiple selves to the work of healing. Mm-hmm. And he was a pioneer in studying what he called exceptional mental states. He gave a series of lectures on exceptional mental states at the Lowell Institute in 1896. And experimenting himself with nitrous oxide, eventually peyote, to explore the mind and how it affects perception and healing.
Yeah, so two questions. The Principles of Psychology, 1890, is that still considered maybe perhaps his most major work?
It's actually the only thing he published that wasn't based on lectures. And he felt it was unwieldy as he finished it. He pared it down to a smaller version for a textbook for university students in 1892 called The Psychology Briefer Course. But really the volume that's most interesting, I think, for most of us was published in 1899, which is called Talks to Teachers on Psychology and to Students on Some of Life's Ideals. And here he boils down what he has learned in his psychological studies to be able to talk about it for pedagogical purposes, because he and the early psychologists of religion were actually very interested in juvenescence and how they might be able to help people mature in their lives. But also, there was a lot of interest in pedagogy. They were trying to make it a science. And when he would give these talks to teachers, the teachers were so refreshed because mostly what he just did was share common sense. And he came out, actually, this is part of the story leading to the varieties of religious experience. He came out west in 1898 to give lectures at the University of California at Berkeley, which was where he introduced his pragmatic philosophy. But he also traveled to Stanford. He went to Monterey and then back to Berkeley, where he gave these talks to teachers and met writers such as Mary Austin, who was in attendance, and he encouraged her to become a writer, and she wrote Land of Little Rain. He was a person who was always engaging with the people who showed up, and they always felt recognized and loved by him.
So you mentioned the importance that perception played for his psychology, and is that also it's related to his experimentation with drugs, I assume, and mind alteration and so forth?
Yes, yes.
So does he have a theory of perception? If not a theory, or does he believe that the mind is essentially a perceptive faculty and not a rational or cognitive faculty?
Yes, I think the simplest answer to that is to say he says he's very interested in attention and that my experience is what I choose to attend to. And I think that's attention as a form of prayer. It's what he comes back to. And experimenting with perception and realizing that whatever one perceives, there's always more. And to stay on the trail of finding out what happens if you continue to engage in what is called sustained voluntary attention as a practice.
Yeah. So 1898 is the Annus Mirabilis. In many ways, it was a crucial breakthrough in his turn towards pragmatism, I guess, and to a different kind of analysis, including of religious experience, no?
Yes, he gives the Ingersoll lectures on immortality. The religious questions that have always been in the back of his mind come to the forefront. He's just published the essays in The Will to Believe, which he thought should be called The Right to Believe.
In fact, I wanted to ask you, The Will to Believe and what you were saying about attention, that what I choose to pay attention to is also, I think, related to his theory of that there's a will to believe certain things because of the subjective, I don't want to say prejudices, but let's say the subjective standpoint of the interrogator, and that therefore science doesn't really ultimately arrive at objective truth because there's always this motivation to see things from a standpoint which ultimately boils down to, has a certain degree of subjectivity to it, no?
Yes.
And therefore, I can pay attention to all sorts of things, but it's primarily what I am already predisposed towards that draws my attention.
And one must be aware of that. As he says, genius is the habit of being able to see in an unhabitual way. And I think there's a quote in James from early on that captures this very well, where he talks about what philosophic study is. He says, philosophic study means the habit of always seeking an alternative, of not taking the usual for granted, of making conventionalities fluid again, of imagining foreign states of mind. And what he was worried about is that the science was becoming scientism. And scientists were all too ready to exclude from their awareness things that didn't fit their preconceptions. And in fact, all of the varieties of religious experience, which begins with a lecture on religion and neurology, is saying, you know, don't include the anomalous events. And I'm going to talk to you about those.
Yeah. So the will to believe is also operative in science.
Yes.
Because the scientists want to believe, for example, in materialism. Or a certain kind of monism, and so forth. So this faculty of the will is crucial and also related to perception, but I don't know how the will and perception relate. But I'm sure that oftentimes, you know, we perceive something that has its source in our will.
Well, but getting back to what James is getting at is that in any endeavor, there is one must be suspicious of one's own conclusions. This goes back to your introduction. And one of his students, George Santayana, said that James believed in the right of believing that you might be right if you believed. Right? So that the will to believe or the right to believe is that there's always insufficient evidence. And then you have to make a Pascalian wager. And this is really at the heart of William James.
Right. So what I was saying about uncertainty does apply in this case to his, I guess, assumption that there's never a completeness to an inquiry.
That's right.
That there's I don't want to say open-endedness, but a certain kind of possibility of oscillating between various alternatives and a non-finalized epistemology.
Yes.
Which then the pragmatic element, from what I understand, but I want to stand corrected because James has always kind of interested in me and also befuddled me. But if a particular thesis or standpoint is useful, and if it somehow helps you get through the day, then it's true in a provisional sense.
In a provisional sense.
Not in an absolute sense, right?
James has said, damn the absolute,
yeah,
in his controversy with his colleague Josiah Royce. And what he was always doing was trying to keep it open-ended. So this is his empiricism. This is his pluralism.
Yeah.
And he's worried that any sense of the absolute leads to a monistic point of view, which then brings a person to what he called a moral holiday. Because if you think that everything is just working out for the best, then what is your role in making things better? Because he's also a meliorist. That is, that we have an obligation.
Well, that's why he's American.
Exactly. And there's always a new beginning.
Right.
And so the provisionality in the open-ended sense, which is also the ability to maintain a sense of surprise.
Yeah.
Because whatever you think, experience might show you something new.
Yeah.
And are you open to that?
Yeah. This is what I found most interesting in reviewing James, you know, for today's show, which is at the ontological level that the universe, almost in a literal sense, is open and is still in the process of being created, and that we, in our own provincial way, are co-creators of what the universe will become. And that is a rather fascinating thing. In other words, we become the collaborators of God.
Yes.
If you want to use his terms for that.
This ushers in the process theology of Alfred North Whitehead that has taken hold here in the 20th and 21st century.
Right. Yeah. And finally, I started understanding why so many European thinkers, intellectuals, philosophers seem so interested in James. I could never quite understand it. It seemed like, at least a few years ago, James was on everyone's tongue, you know, they were talking. And I think that they saw some connection between what he called his radical empiricism with what their continental tradition identified as a kind of post-metaphysical philosophy of not weak subjectivity, but post-subjectivity. I don't know how you would want to characterize some kind of Heideggerian, where you being beyond the metaphysical as such.
Yes. James was actually surprised that pragmatism caught on the way it did. Yeah. And the Italian philosopher Papini, he went to visit him in Rome, and he was just fascinated to see this exfoliate. And also in Oxford, it was catching on. And he said, really, all I was trying to do was create the conditions for better conversations.
Yeah. And which Richard Rorty, our colleague and one-time guest on Entitled Opinions, this idea of philosophy as conversation, I didn't realize just how Jamesian that inheritance was on the part of Richard Rorty, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Although there's a tendency to throw philosophy or a good deal of the history of philosophy out the window as actually a misunderstanding, and along with it, truth and verification. Otherwise, I won't get into that.
Well, this is why Cornel West calls his book on the pragmatist the American evasion of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. The Gifford lectures were important. No, we talked about the year of 1898, but we go on now to 1901, 1902, and this is where the varieties of religious experience really starts incubating and taking shape. No?
Yes.
So why was that such an important milestone in his biography?
There's an interesting story about the Giffords and James, because Lord Adam Gifford was present when Ralph Waldo Emerson was giving lectures in Edinburgh in 1834 and was so impressed by Emerson that later in his life in the 1880s, he endowed this lectureship that eventually William was invited to. When he was first invited in 1899, he was suffering considerably from a heart ailment, so he postponed for a year. And then he worked on the first series for 1901, had them all written up, the 10 lectures, then went back in 1902 in the summer for the second series, and then published it right away. It was a tremendous effort he had to make, both to overcome his physical challenges, but also to really grapple with the issues that we find in the varieties of religious experience text itself.
So there were 10 lectures, and which essentially the book itself.
You know? 20 lectures all told, 10 lectures each time, summer of 1901, summer of 1902. So in 01, he goes and there are theologians and there are natural scientists. Yeah. I'm going to be too scientific for the theologians and too theological for the scientists. And he begins with talking about religion and neurology, what he calls medical materialism. Why are we reducing everything to just a physical, neurological reaction? Isn't there more to it than that? And what he's trying to do is raise up the voices that science is pushing to the side. And actually, to read that lecture today, you see how current it is.
Do we know how it was received?
Yes. The lecture audience grew and grew. The word went out. People were excited by what he was doing and couldn't wait for the second installment the next year.
Is that right? Yeah. I would not have guessed that because he's not easy to grasp. I'm not sure he's the most lucid or, let's say, transparent writer. There's one always has to make an effort, and I imagine having to listen to some of those things would present a challenge in itself, but good for him.
There's more in the text than was presented in the lectures. And he's a very good storyteller. He's a very engaging speaker. Everyone who heard them felt they were focused and hearing, and it was generating conversations.
So it presents a critique of reductionism.
Yes.
But at the same time, it's not a leap into the claim that there's just this spiritual order, which is above, you know.
Well, he says there's an unseen world, and our work is to find ourselves more and more in alignment with that.
Right. So it doesn't reject or repudiate. It wants to include that spiritual
world. That's right.
World. And let's go through some of the basic arguments of the varieties of religious experience, because a number of people have heard of that book. I'm not sure a lot of people actually have read it and understood it.
Yes, maybe I can talk about it in a way that will help the reader approach it with a sense of some kind of narrative unity.
Yeah.
James referred to himself as a Methodist minus a savior. And so there's a pattern in the book, an archetypal pattern that's common in Protestant religion of the stages of a person becoming elect, part of the elect, then finding a vocation, then having some kind of conversion or awakening experience, then living a sanctified life in tune with what one learned through awakening, and then ending in this stage of glorification, or what James will write about is mysticism, which is living a life that's enshrined in love. And so James, in his lectures, takes an ideal, typical religious genius, religious virtuoso. And if you think that as you go through these chapters, you're moving with this person through these stages, the book makes a lot more sense.
Okay, so let me quote this very famous definition that he gives of religion. That's the feelings, acts, and experiences of individual men in their solitude, so far as they apprehend themselves to stand in relation to whatever they may consider the divine. Now, for someone who's been nourished on a different tradition, especially Vico and other theories of religion, this sounds like, to me, a very naive, or not naive, but a highly delimited concept of the religious, where it's based on experience and it's based on the individual in solitude.
Yes.
Whereas I think it's, to me, seems more than evident that world religions have been the essential binding element for communities, for the foundation of nations and of empires and law and all sorts of other things. So this highly American individualistic view that religion amounts to a personal experience and that you can choose whatever you may want to consider the divine, I mean, it's very loosey-goosey. It's very countercultural. It's very 60s in some sense. very Californian. In fact, you gave me a beautiful book by Eric Davis on
the visionary state.
The visionary state of California, in which he quotes that and he says, yeah, this is California. Whatever you want to consider the divine, you follow the bliss, and it all comes back to the individual rooted in experience. Is that too narrow a definition or understanding of religion?
Well, that quotation, James says, just in advance of it, for the purpose of these lectures, this is the definition. And he is, yes, very, very interested in the individual's experience, highly focused on the subjective experience and what people, how it motivates people to live their lives. So he's fully aware of the communal dimensions, but he's also aware that the pattern of religious history is that there are sages and prophets and individuals who have an awakening experience, and people gather around it and then create an institution that basically suffocates the original inspiration.
Right.
And so he wants to focus in on the original inspiration for well-known teachers, but also for individuals, because from the pragmatic point of view, he's not so interested in the origins, but then what will be the outcomes, which is why he makes it whatever person considers to be the divine, which could be a whole range of things that inspire, let's say, mystical insight or an awareness that one's soul is larger than one thinks and one is part of a greater whole. But also, you know, his championing of the individual is because he felt that all too often we fail to see the soul of another person because they're so different from us. He had an essay, 1899, called On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings, which emphasized the way in which we are hardly ever really aware of the other person and where they're coming from and what has informed the way they're approaching life. And he wanted to give permission to be open to everyone and to learn from everyone, especially where religious experience is concerned.
No, I can see that, but I can also understand how it's a more appropriate sort of attitude in a country like America, which is so wildly diverse in terms of who the other is, unlike societies in which religion has given a certain kind of identity to a community so that the other person is not this unknown X. The other person is very much a version of yourself because that
culture.
Other person has been kind of educed into the religious foundations, the religious presuppositions and values and so forth, so that you can count on that person being somewhat like you.
Anyway. Well, James was advocating for spiritual democracy.
Yeah.
And in the American context, that makes a lot of sense.
And this emphasis on love that you mentioned a few minutes ago, this, that would seem to make him quite the soul brother of someone like Walt Whitman. And
yes.
Yet we know that it's just not that easy, right? And this goes back to the varieties of religious experience, which has a certain typology of certain types of people.
Yes.
Right? Can we talk about that?
Yes. Yes. His relation with Whitman is, he goes hot and cold on Uncle Walt Whitman. And in the varieties, he has this healthy-minded type, which is an expression of this mind cure movement, this sense of healing due to or living without really being aware of the shadow side of life, looking away from hardship and evil and difficulty. It's ignorance is bliss point of view. And he puts Walt Whitman in that category, quoting from some of Whitman's expansive poetry, which will give you a sense that the sky is always blue. Very unfair to Whitman, who knew from his own time in the Civil War and working with soldiers on the field, the shadow side. He knew it very well.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And the same with St. Francis of Assisi, who he puts in the healthy-minded category. St. Francis had his own travails and also battlefield experiences early on.
So the two types, main types in the varieties are the healthy-minded, and the sick soul.
Yes. Right?
And he seems to have a certain impatience for the healthy-minded.
Yes.
They're evading a kind of confrontation with the real.
He says they live in a one-story universe. They're shallow.
Yeah. Although, it's unfair if you start taking examples, as you just pointed out yourself. I mean, Walt Whitman, far more than James, I imagine, you know, was right there in the hospitals facing the absolute disease, physiological on the one hand, and also a nation's disease where it's at war with itself. And so anything but turning away from, you know, the dark side of things,
yes,
but rather finding the strength to say yes in the face of the tragic and the dark and so forth. So kind of yay saying that is not just evasion. And St. Francis also, I mean, if anyone knew what misery, human misery and evil, St. Francis was one of those. But trying to find a way to keep the, what we would call hope alive, so as not to succumb to utter depression and debilitation.
And that's what's happened to the sick-souled individual. They're in that hell you mentioned in the introduction, where there's no way out, pushed to extremes. And once pushed to extremes, often will have an experience which reframes perception, and suddenly they're living in a double-story universe.
And these are the sick souls, so we have the double-storied universe, right?
That's right, because they know how bad it can be.
Yeah. So what do you make of it, that theory?
Well, he talks about then the sick soul is a divided self. And there's a chapter then that follows this on the divided self and its unification, that a person's center of energy shifts so that they're living with their highest energy, their best human self. And there's kind of a black box here because James says, well, just how this happens is religion secret, and you have to be a religious person of the extremer type yourself to understand what has happened. Yeah. But then the book is full of these stories, these awakening and these conversion stories. And in the end, the book is an exercise in hermeneutics, going into these texts and finding out, because that's what we have. We have these stories and finding out what do we think is really going on here.
Right. So two questions, Mark. One has to do with a kind of intellectual curiosity. Did James know anything about Friedrich Nietzsche, who had a lot to say about the sick-souled and the healthy-minded? No?
He only knew a little about Nietzsche. He quotes him very briefly, actually in relation to his perception of Nietzsche's anti-democratic impulses. But, you know, his colleague Josiah Royce was the main philosopher to introduce Nietzsche to American readers. Mm-hmm. But James himself, and Nietzsche was not familiar with James.
Yeah. And you talked about these conversion moments of where you change your perception of things. Did William James undergo such particular moments? And he has a lot to say about mysticism also in the book. Do you believe that he had any experiences that were transformative in the religious sense, and even mystical ones?
Yes. He's cagey about this, but yes. His was what's called extrovertive nature mysticism. And there are stories, especially in the correspondence, which, by the way, reading the correspondence available in 12 volumes from the University of Virginia Press is just so much fun, and you learn so much. But had encounters with the more than human world out hiking in the mountains that were transformative for him.
Yeah. He walked a lot.
He loved to walk. He loved to be in the mountains.
I think that's how he strained his heart.
It is. Yeah. It is.
What's that phrase that you ever not quite.
Yes.
So you brought that to my attention in relation to, you know, my intro.
Yes.
Where does that occur, and what did he mean by that?
Yes, this became a hallmark of his radical empiricism, that there's always more. And actually, his more is a riff on what Emerson is doing in his essay Circles, one lives with a constant sense of ever not quite. And James himself, when he came to die, felt that he had built half an archway and the other half remained to be constructed.
Yeah.
Although there's also an interesting quotation where he's somewhat fatigued by living in a still-to-be-made world, and he writes to a dear friend, you know, maybe now give me a world already made.
Well, yes, and the problem with the unfinished world is that death becomes meaningless in this philosophical sense that, you know, when you lived in a cyclical conception of things where when you come to die, life has given you all that it has to give and that you've reached a kind of end or satiation. But where things are in a constant condition of unfinishedness, things keep going and going and going. And death is just something that has a kind of meaningless termination to an ongoing story that you're not going to be a part of, as opposed to the experience of death in different sort of traditions where there is a fulfillment and that death, yes, is a culmination and not the termination of life.
That's right. That's a huge change as you go into modernity and a loss of the sense of the cycles of which one is a part and being full of life when you die, feeling that you had lived deliberately and accomplished something in the life that gave it a sense of a satisfying,
yes,
ending.
Right.
And so—
Which you get in Thoreau.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I went to the woods to live deliberately so that when I came to die, I would not find that I had not lived.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting to me to think about this because in this world where death has less meaning, the highest compliment would be to say of someone, he or she is ahead of her time.
Right.
Right? And that's that ever not quite sense. And I've always thought of James that way. Right? I mean, James was 100 years at least ahead of his time, especially where the field of religious studies is concerned.
Yeah.
He was opening all kinds of doors that we're still exploring now.
Yeah.
And actually what he was doing was pretty edgy in its own time because the World Parliament of Religions had convened in Chicago in 1893. People were becoming aware of the varieties worldwide. And James puts in his book stories from Hindus and Buddhists and Sufis. And so this was the beginning of the comparative philosophy of religions, which is what makes the field of religious studies so exciting.
Right. So I guess, you know, to bring our conversation to an end, it's your interest in comparative religions that makes you a companion or makes William James a kind of constant companion for you when you roam the streets and the mountains here in California, right?
Yeah.
That's the part of James that excites you the most, more than pragmatism and principles of psychology.
You know, it's all fascinating and I love to read James, but I also like to emulate his person as much as possible. His ability to meet with and be open to the entire range,
right,
of people and experiences. So when I'm walking into an unknown situation, a temple in a tradition I'm not familiar with, I'm saying to myself, okay, let's just be William James.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank our guest, Mark Gonerman, not only for coming on to talk about William James, but also to, you've inspired me to think of James differently than I had before, because until now, I had great deal of difficulty getting excited by him for some reason. But after this conversation, I think I'm distinctly more Jamesian than before. So thank you for that. Mark Gonerman has been my guest. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Anger, he smiles towering in shiny metallic purple armor. Queen jealousy, envy waits behind him. Her fiery green gown sneers at the grassy ground. Blue are the life-giving waters taken for granted. They quietly understand. Once
sappy turquoise armies lay opposite ready, but wonder why the fight is on. But they're all.